Blog Talk Radio.
Well, it's lonesome in this old town. Everybody puts me down. I'm a face without a name, just walking in the rain, going back to Houston, Houston, Houston. I got holes in both of my shoes while I'm a walking case of the blues. Saw a dollar yesterday, but the wind blew it away, going back to Houston, Houston, Houston. I haven't eaten in about a week. I'm so hungry when I walk, I squeak. Nobody calls me friend. It's sad the shape I'm in, going back to Houston, Houston, Houston. Going back to Houston, Houston, Houston. I got a girl with mail for me. Well, at least she said she'd be. I got a home and a big warm bed and a feather pillow for my head. Going back to Houston, Houston, Houston. Well, it's lonesome in this old town. Everybody puts me down. I'm a face without a name, just walking in the rain, going back to Houston, Houston, Houston. Going back to Houston, Houston.
The one guy that Frank Sinatra wished he could really be, and that is, of course, Dean Martin. Hey, everybody, James Bostic here. A conservative perspective on the, where are we? It's Tuesday. Then it must be Patriot Nation Radio. And we do this, well, we have been doing it live, Tuesdays and Thursdays. but we're not doing it exactly that way anymore. There have been some changes, and I'm kind of excited about them. Thursdays these days, I'm taking a class, and I'm taking a class in how to take tests. Okay. That's what's going on. And what it is, they're called the praxis examinations. And what they are, they're examinations that you take in order to get your, teaching certificate, teaching classification. And with that, whoops, hold on, let me turn the speaker off there. With that, I'll be able to teach. A friend of mine that I work with, we hit upon basically the idea of a driver's ed class for special ed kids. And anybody that knows me, I've been involved in special education for these 17 years. So Thursdays is when we have our meeting. So every other Thursday, I'll be able to do a show. But right now, on those other Thursdays, I won't be able to be with you, and I hope that you'll forgive me. But these classes are pretty important, and they're going to lead off into something big. Speaking of something big, our friend, Mr. Michael Cutler, is here with us again this evening. I like to bring him in. I try to talk to him at least two or three times a month, but I like to bring him in at least every four or five weeks or so, because, the guy knows what he's talking about, and I like having him around, and I really don't think I need any more reason than that. And speaking of which, we're going to go ahead and bring him up now. He is a former federal agent with the Immigration Naturalization Services, 30 years experience, and his bailiwick, his areas of expertise moved from counterterrorism and drug enforcement and organized crime and immigration fraud and illegal immigration as they pertain to our immigration system. And once again, tonight, with immigration in the forefront, you know, it's been way over a year now, our southern border has fundamentally been porous. I can't even begin to count the number of people that we have seen come through. And this is a very, very, very serious problem. You're not going to hear about it on the news because they don't want you to know about it. They're going to downplay it. They're going to poo-poo the whole thing. And here's one guy that don't take any poo-poo off of anybody, our pal, Mr. Michael Cutler. Michael, welcome back. I'm glad to have you
here with us
this evening.
It's always great joining you. Thank you for having me. I have to tell you, my level of frustration, I'll share this with you and your audience, is someplace beyond the stratosphere. I think it's in lunar orbit at this point. You know, I've testified before something on the order of 17 hearings in the House and Senate. I gave testimony to the 9/11 Commission. I lived through 9/11. My neighbors were killed. I'm a New Yorker. The ashes landed on my house from the conflagration at Ground Zero. And as you point out, I've worked on terrorism investigations. I've worked on narcotics investigations. Half of my 30-year career was spent over at DEA, first with DEA intelligence, and then my final 10 years as a senior agent with the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force. And I've worked with foreign governments. And I thought after 9/11, we were finally heading down the right path, which is why I was called by both the Democrats and the Republicans to go to Washington and try to fix the broken immigration system. And for about 4 or 5 years, it seemed as though they were essentially serious. And then something called Citizens United was decided by the Supreme Court, which basically said that unlimited amounts of money could be pumped into political campaigns. And at that point, the entire landscape changed. The news media changed. It was as though someone had flipped the switch. You know, you went home from work on Friday, and Monday you came to work, and it was a whole new ballgame. And suddenly, nobody wanted to talk about what we really needed to do. The news media essentially shut down. And what had happened was the globalists now had the opportunity to provide unlimited funding to the political campaigns. The threat of terrorism, by the way, folks, I'm not trying to keep you awake at night, but as I told Jim Sensenbrenner when he was the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, I said, Mr. Chairman, if I can't sleep at night, sure as hell, I don't want you to be able to sleep at night. We need to understand the dangers. And what the Biden administration has done is only the latest example of globalism, the most pernicious, the most widespread. You talk about a southern border. We don't have a southern border. It's not even a southern speed bump. It's just not there anymore. It's gone. Effectively, America is a country without borders, and a country without borders cannot be defended. So I wonder, why did I keep going down to D.C.? Not only for hearings, but I had private meetings with members of Congress, with their staffers. I mean, I got in my car. My car steered itself to the Jersey Turnpike and started heading south automatically. All I had to do was turn on the engine. Right? And suddenly, it's as though there had been no hearings. There was no 9/11 commission. And it's both parties. And if you think that our government represents you as the average American, you're a fool. Both parties are in on this. I call them the Republicrats, okay? The idea that we're giving driver's licenses to illegal aliens so they could get to work, just stop and think of the enormity of that betrayal. I don't know how many of you folks know this, but initially the immigration laws were not enforced by the Justice Department, but the Labor Department. I'm a registered Democrat. I'm seriously considering just registering as an independent because neither party gives a rat's tail about any of us, folks. Let's cut past the nonsense and the fertilizer. The immigration laws were enforced by the Department of Labor to make certain that no American worker would have to compete with a foreign worker for a job, period. Full stop, end of sentence. the immigration laws that are on the books now that they are desperate in Washington to change and, quote, modernize, stipulates that no alien should be employed in the United States as long as there is an American who has the qualifications and is ready, willing, and able to do the work in that particular geographic location, period. That's what it looks like when the government stands up for its own people. Stop and think about it. So you have the parties say, oh, well, how can these people get to work? Why are they going to work when they're taking jobs that should go to Americans? And then my friends on the conservative side will say, well, it's inflationary if we can't allow the immigrants, quote unquote, to work, meaning illegal aliens or aliens with work visas. I hope it's going to cause wages to go up. That's the whole point. But by the way, your taxes, if we didn't have such crooks in politics, would go down because then you wouldn't have to provide food stamps, housing, and all kinds of other subsidies and safety net programs because people could actually support themselves by going to work. What a novel idea. Think about that idea. Imagine having a job where you got your paycheck, and without getting a penny from anybody more, you could put on the lights, you could go on vacation, and you could actually buy a new car every couple of years and take your family on vacation. That's the America that I grew up in. And then when you have companies being told that they need to pay a $15 an hour minimum wage, and my friends on the conservative side say, oh, my God, minimum wage. Well, I believe in a minimum wage, not if you're running a small mom-and-pop store. That ought to be between you and the people you hire. Whatever they're willing to work for, you hire them, and that's truly a free market economy. But when you're McDonald's or you're Amazon or you're Google, whatever, then you have to impose standards because these crooks will bleed you dry if they can get away with it. Think about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. I know so many conservatives say, oh, we don't need regulations. Okay, how did that work out with Boeing and the MAX jet that became a MAX hole in the ground? There are a lot of stupid regulations. I agree. We need to get rid of stupid and conflicting regulations because sometimes you could follow the OSHA regulations and violate the EPA rate. I mean, that's nuts. So we need to coordinate so it's reasonable and fair and makes sense. But the reason that you have environmental laws and safety laws is because of thugs like the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, where people were forced to work in factories that had no exits out of the building. And I can tell you, I raided factories 20 years ago, 25 years ago, where the fire exits were blocked. You had people working literally in a sweatshop, and I kid you not, that's the appropriate term. During the summer, no air conditioning, big, filthy, encrusted fans blasting hot air around the room, and these were steam presses going and women and men working at sewing machines, the dust flying everywhere, and the temperature in the room was 120 degrees. That's a sweatshop, literally. And then you looked around, and you said, my gosh, they've got garbage and cartons and boxes blocking the fire escapes. So if there was a fire, nobody was getting out. They'd all be crispy critters. So when you see that kind of abuse, like it or not, you have to impose regulations so that people don't die simply going to their job. But the idea was that the government of the United States should be looking out for the best interests of its citizens. Wasn't that what Lincoln talked about, a government of the people, by the people, and for the people? Not the bribers. And today they talk about Joe Smith is getting ready to run for Congress, and how do they know? He's amassed a war chest of $3.6 million. He's a serious candidate. What do you think the founding fathers would think, or what they would say, or maybe what they would do if they read that headline? You need $3 million to run for a seat in the Senate? Really?
No, but you might need it to buy one.
Exactly. Exactly. And I was just talking to a guy who's running as a Republican against another Republican right now in the primary. And he said, Mike, you're not going to believe the race that I'm in. The woman that I'm running against has invested a couple of $100 million in factories in China, and she's about to put more money into China. By the way, I don't know if you saw the news today. Cobalt is a very important element where the manufacture of batteries is concerned. The richest cobalt mine is in the Congo, which used to be part of an American company until Joe Biden's son allegedly helped to transfer ownership of that mine that produces cobalt that's essential for car batteries and all the electric cars to China. What do you have to do to commit treason in this country today? That's what I want to find out, besides standing up at a school board meeting and speak out against critical race theory.
Yeah. That's it.
And you're seeing
that's
the same
the
nonsense playing out in Canada now, aren't you? The Canucks are doing the same damn thing. What do you mean you've got your – now, look, the blockade is terrible. I get it. People in those neighborhoods must be going out of their mind. But there's no violence. It doesn't look like what happened in Minnesota and other cities around the country when people rioted and burnt the cities down and shot people. This is peaceful. I mean, it really is peaceful. Not like the make-believe peaceful in Seattle, but it's, if you watch, it's really a festival kind of an environment because people are upset that they're being forced to take a vaccine that they don't want to take if they want to keep their jobs. Okay? And I get that. That's your own body. Whatever happened to freedom of choice? Right? So they're protesting. And what does Trudeau do? He declares them terrorists, seizes bank accounts. They're going to seize their vehicles. A lawyer who worked for Obama, now you would think, and she's a law professor, I wish I had the article in front of me, said that what they should do is slash the tires of these trucks and take their property, et cetera, et cetera. Well, wait a minute. We have law to prevent violence. We have law so that we have conflict resolution that doesn't result in violence. So how does the law professor say that the solution is violence and you're supposed to be an advocate for law? I took a class in criminology, James, way back when in the dim, distant past when we went to school on horseback. not quite, but almost. And I took a couple of criminology classes. I took all kinds of crazy classes. And the professor was right. He said that the reason we have a criminal justice system is so that if someone's sister gets raped, the brother isn't going to go out there with a shotgun to settle the score because the system will deal with the rapist. Not in New York, not in Chicago, not in California. They're turning violent thugs loose on the street. My fear is at some point people are going to say, this government lacks legitimacy. My family member was raped, was assaulted, was killed, was bludgeoned. And I'm going to get my pound of flesh because the system doesn't do anything to take care of the victims, because it doesn't. And at that point, where are we? And I think I know why this is happening. And if you really want nightmares, hang around for a couple of minutes, and I see a parallel in not distant history. But just to go back to this point about the immigrants, quote-unquote, meaning illegal aliens, are requiring driver's licenses to go to work when they shouldn't be working. See, I have institutional memory that nobody else does. I love Tom Homan. I know the man. I've met with him. I've met other people who became the leaders in the Trump administration. They don't have the institutional memory I have because they don't have as much gray hair as I have. I'm on the wrong side of 70, okay? And when I was a new immigration agent, we would go into a factory. And if we found somebody working who came to the United States on a tourist visa, we're not talking about a guy that ran the border. The guy came on a tourist visa. The guy is attending college, but never got permission to work. So they're working in this factory. They're working in a gas station. You know how we resolved that problem? This is going to shock everybody, but we took out our nice, shiny handcuffs, arrested them, put them in the back of our car, locked them up overnight, and the next morning they saw an immigration judge, and by the end of the week they were back in their home country. Period. Nobody protested, nobody fainted, and everyone said, well, that makes sense. You're protecting Americans' jobs. And I remember one case that was very rewarding for me. There was a gas station back at Kennedy Airport. And I went in to get gas one day, and the attendant could barely speak English. So being an immigration agent, I started to question him about his immigration status, and it turned out he was an illegal alien. So my partner and I arrested him. And we were working the 4 to midnight shift. Well, we noticed a pattern. If you went into the gas station at 10 o'clock in the morning, they had some American guy working there. If you went there after 8 o'clock at night, they would have illegal aliens working there. Now, in those days, it was not a crime for knowingly hiring illegal aliens, but we certainly could arrest the illegal alien. So my partner and I decided that we would adopt the gas station. Now, what do I mean by that? Once a week, somewhere around 8 o'clock at night, we would pull into the gas station, and we would arrest the illegal aliens, and there were usually two or three of them working there. And they would have to call the boss, and the boss would have to come out, because otherwise, either they were going to lock up the gas station, and these guys didn't even have the key, or they'd wind up leaving it unattended. Well, the cute story is, guy used to go to sleep early. So I remember one time we hit the gas station 10 o'clock at night. The guy actually came out in his bathrobe and pajamas. He was scared to death that we were going to leave before he got there. And he bought a change of clothing and threw it in the back of his car. And I said to him, at least once a week, you can anticipate getting a phone call. It'll be us. Knock it off. Hire Americans. He thought I was bluffing. That's a big mistake. So we kept on going yeah. back, and he kept showing up in his bathrobe. Eventually, he said he was sleeping in his clothing because he was anticipating phone calls. He finally got the message. He was a little bit thick. And finally, one day, I pulled into the gas station, and there were these two black young men working in the gas station. And when I pulled in, the guy looked at me. He says, "You guys are the immigration agents, aren't you?" I said, "How do you know?" It turned out that both he and his buddy were going to college, and this gas station job was helping them to pay their tuition. The guy finally got the message. And they thanked us. They said, "Can we at least get you a free cup of coffee?" I said, "No, the word free doesn't work, but I'll buy a cup of coffee from you, and we can sit down and have coffee together," which we did. And they told me how important that job was to them because they desperately needed to work to help pay the bills so they could go to college and get their degrees. I hope by now that their engineers or school teachers are doing something fabulous with their lives. And this was very rewarding. This was very, because this is on a personal level. These two kids growing up in a tough neighborhood with no money had a legitimate job that were helping them to pay to go to college. It does not get better than that. But that's what the immigration laws were supposed to be about. And suddenly we're being told, "Oh, we can't hire those American kids. They would expect a living wage. Are you crazy?" Alan Greenspan testified for Chuck Schumer and said the solution to wage inequality is to make American high-tech workers compete with foreign workers because they're being paid far too much money, and that's only because they're being shielded from foreign competition. We need to remove that shield, and then when we reduce their wages, we would reduce inequality in wages between Americans with skills and those with lesser skills. I kid you not, he actually said it, and you could read the transcript. I actually had the video up on the Senate website for a few years. I was in such a state of rage, so I watched that hearing streaming live. I was on a radio show the next day, and the young lady whose program I was on knows that or knew that I have a wacky sense of humor, and you know that I do. You know, you get twisted after too many years in law enforcement. So I was on her show, and I said, "You know, when I watched Greenspan testify for Chucky Schumer, I knew I was witnessing a first." And she said, "Mike, I know I'm standing on thin ice asking you the question, but what kind of a first was it?" I said, "It was the first time I'd ever seen someone suffering from rigor mortis testify before the Senate." She told me she spent the rest of the program mopping up her mascara from laughing so hard. But nobody reported on it. I want all of you to just stop and think of the enormity of that statement. The solution to wage inequality is to destroy the wages for Americans who have advanced education, master's degrees in the sciences. They're making too much money. We need to import an army of foreign workers because when we slash their wages, then the working poor won't have anyone to be envious of anymore, so we will have attained wage equality. How? Not by raising up the wages and conditions for Americans, but by throwing them through the floorboards. Why? Because corporations could then make more money. This is part of what corporations call cost out. Two of my kids are engineers. One of my sons did something known as cost out for a major company. When he was fresh out of engineering school, he and a bunch of other engineers sat at workbenches, and what did they do? Figure out ways of making switches and circuit breakers with a little bit less metal and a little bit fewer parts, and so they made a piece of garbage that had to go back to the underwriter labs for recertification, and when they just barely got it across the finish line, they put it into the same old box but it wasn't the same product that you thought it was from one of America's premier companies. It was a piece of trash that probably wouldn't last a year. So they destroyed their reputation, and that company now is in the garbage can because they didn't care about reputation. I'm going to put it bluntly. Whores don't care about reputation, and corporations don't care about reputations, nor do politicians. They just care about the size of their bank accounts. What do you think of that?
Spot on. Spot on. You know, you mentioned earlier trying to hold one party or another accountable for what's going on, and that was like we were talking on Sunday, both wings of the same bird, and it's all it is. They're all crooks.
Yes, they are. And they're doing the bidding of the people who employ them. But going back to that woman who wants to build more factories, I said, how are you depicting this woman on your website? He says, well, I have it all over my website that she has a conflict of interest. I said, that's old hat. Here's how you really need to explain it to the voters. She has become or seeking to become her own lobbyist. Just like Robert Goodlatte, the former chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, supposed conservative Republican who always sought to bring in more H-1B visas. You know why? It's called conflict of interest. You know why? Because Bob Goodlatte is an immigration lawyer who had a multi-state law practice who specialized in, are you ready, H-1B visas. That's a conflict of interest. Zoe Lofgren, who is now the chair of the House Immigration Subcommittee, and I've testified before Zoe numerous times, is an immigration lawyer. I believe she had been the president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association, but whether or not she was the president doesn't matter. She's certainly a key player for the American Immigration Lawyers Association. So this goes back to what immigration has become, a delivery system that delivers an unlimited supply of cheap exploitable labor, foreign tourists, foreign students, and for the immigration lawyers out there, an unlimited supply of clientele. So Joe Biden, and I just wrote an article a couple of weeks ago for usinc.org, how the Biden administration has become the biggest human trafficking operation in the history of the United States, because that's really what they are. And they've taken the Border Patrol agents and turned them into facilitators. They're actually transporting illegal aliens to hubs of transportation so they can be dispersed across the United States. And my good friend Lou Barletta, who's running for governor in Pennsylvania, was on Fox News a couple of weeks ago because he had filmed a couple of these ghost flights around Christmas Eve flying into Pennsylvania in the dead of night. And if you remember, Jen Psaki, who gives me fits, got into it with Ducey from Fox News when he said these flights are coming in the dead of night. And she said, no, it's early morning, not dead of night. And I thought, I can't believe what I'm listening to. This was an effort to sidestep the whole issue. Oh, this isn't dead of night. It's early in the morning.
It's very, very early in the morning. And they call it a.m., Mike.
You can't make this up. I mean, the chutzpah. You know, I tell you, chutzpah is a Yiddish term. It sort of means, you know, unmitigated gall. And the classic example of chutzpah is the kid who kills both parents and then pleads for mercy because he's an orphan. I have to tell you, Jen Psaki surpasses that kid. This is a level of arrogance by what is supposed to be a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. It doesn't give a rat's tail about the people. And it's both parties. It was George W. Bush who created DHS in such a way that I came to call the Department of Homeland Surrender. And now they've changed the mission statement to DHS, where Citizenship and Immigration Services is concerned. They've stripped from it the phrase to protect the American people or the homeland, and it's simply to maintain the tradition of America being a welcoming nation. Come one, come all. So it's remarkable to me that you look at what's playing out in America, where this administration and these crazy Democrats are trying, I think, to ignite a race war. I don't know any other way of saying it. I don't know any other way to see it, to talk about white supremacists being the problem. Let me be clear, okay? I'm Jewish. I hate the KKK. I hate any group that has supremacists at the end. The Nazis were very good at eugenics and the concept of the master race, supremacists, okay? We're all human beings. You know, when I was with John Lewis, the late civil rights leader who became a member of Congress, Sheila Jackson Lee, and believe it or not, Sheila called me for two hearings. She had called me to testify at the hearing about how two of the dead terrorists, 6 months after 9/11, could have been granted authorization to attend flight school. 6 months after the attacks, Muhammad Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi. It was Sheila Jackson Lee, seconded by the Republican chairman of the House Judiciary Committee at the time, Jim Sensenbrenner, who invited me to testify at that hearing. I did another hearing for Sheila also. So there was a time when there was a rational process in place where people said, we've got to protect America. I was humbled. I was honored. And to be honest, I felt the weight on my shoulders when I was contacted by the Congress, and they said, could you come testify to help make sure America doesn't get hit again? I had the same emotions when the 9/11 Commission sent me an email and said there are concerns that we could be attacked again. We need your expertise because in my career, I've investigated and arrested terrorists. My first fraud investigation, a kid from Israel with an altered visa came into the United States. It was supposed to be a mundane, nothing to see here, take a statement that he's going home kind of a thing. This was my first assigned case. Turned out he was here to get money for the PLO to blow up an oil refinery in Israel. I played a hunch, and fortunately, as a result of that, we prevented the bombing of a refinery in Israel. And I was told by the Israeli consul general in New York and their police general, who was here at the time, that we saved an awful lot of lives because the attack would have been successful and would have killed many people. In fact, I had dinner at the consul's house in Manhattan, and he brought me to tears. He said to me, Mr. Cutler, I was having dinner with him and his family, and he said, I want you to know that there will always be children playing in my country who would not have been born had you not uncovered that plot to blow up the refinery. And I didn't even know what to say. He brought tears to my eyes. It was a very emotional moment. I worked very closely with the Israeli National Police for the balance of my career. In fact, the night of 9/11, a former police general who'd been assigned to the New York consulate for 3 years called me up to make certain that I was okay, that my family was okay, that we weren't killed or injured in the collapse of the towers. And they were so helpful to us, and we were helpful to them. I arrested a guy who was wanted for murder in Israel. We sent him back to Israel to stand trial. He was found guilty and sentenced to a lengthy jail sentence. He had killed a Palestinian prostitute. The guy was as crazy as a bedbug. He was into weightlifting and was taking huge amounts of steroids. When we arrested him, there were sparse furnishings in the house, except lots of weights and a weight bench to work out on, and bottles and vials of all kinds of steroids and garbage. And we actually almost needed three sets, not two sets, but three sets of handcuffs to take this guy into custody, because the cuffs barely fit on his wrist. It was on the first click on the handcuff. And then we had to loop handcuffs together because we couldn't get his hands together. That's how big this guy was. He looked like Arnold Schwarzenegger on steroids. That's how big. He had something like a 26-inch neck. Okay?
Jeez.
So we took this beast. We sent him home to stand trial, to face justice. And Israel sent like a dozen Israeli National Police officers to accompany him back on an El Al jet. Normally, we put these people on an airplane, and we'd pay the fare, and we would have to send our agents. In this case, Israel provided us with free transportation. All we had to do is deliver him to the airport. They put him on an El Al jet, and the next thing I've got from the Israeli consulate was a news clipping where this guy was found guilty and sentenced to, I think it was 20 or 25 years in jail for the murder. The guy was a lunatic. So, you know, but the reason I'm telling you the story is that immigration law enforcement is supposed to protect America and maintain a sense of justice around the world by removing criminals who are wanted for crimes in their home countries or elsewhere. There's nothing racist about it. By the way, this Israeli, I can assure you, was a white guy. He didn't have brown skin, didn't have black skin. He wasn't a Latino. All these lies, oh, it's about Latinos. No, it's not. No, it's not. It's about justice. It's about people, and people are people are people. And I don't care what your race is or your religion or your ethnicity. Every group has the good, the bad, and the ugly, because that's human nature. We all bleed red when we're injured, and our species, you know, human nature is human nature. I worked closely with the Japanese. I got an award from the Japanese National Police. I worked with the Brits and the Canadians. Human nature is human nature. And now you've got a government in place that believes that law enforcement is the enemy. We're going to defund the police. Now, are there cops that do things they shouldn't do? Absolutely. But here's something that I find interesting, and I want your audience to chew on this idea. What happened to George Floyd was wrong. But to talk about George Floyd as though he was some kind of a hero, George Floyd had done time for robbing a pregnant woman by shoving a gun into her belly where the baby was. And we hear about how we have to live up to the legacy of George Floyd. What does that mean? We have to go out and stick guns into the bellies of pregnant ladies? Are you crazy? The guy shouldn't have died, okay? The police should have acted differently. Okay, fine. I'm not arguing. But if you look at George Floyd and you look at Michael Brown and you look at most of these other cases, they all have something in common. And you know what they have in common? These individuals resisted arrest when they were encountered by law enforcement and things escalated from there. Now, I've made many arrests in my career. By the way, I'm proud of the fact that I've never, ever in my entire 30-year career been charged with, accused of excessive force or doing anything inappropriate. I played it by the numbers. I was very careful because my reputation was on the line and criminal justice is on the line. And I used to tell the young kids when they came on the job, just as I had old timers mentor me, I mentored them. And I said, you're going to arrest people where your brain is going to scream, this man needs to die. Okay, people that have killed children and raped little girls. I'm serious.
Right.
Yeah, I know.
But I said, if you really want to do harm to a scumbag, the best way you can do serious harm is don't touch him, because you're going to create a problem for yourself, and we're not judge, jury, and executioner. Our job is to deliver these pieces of trash. I used to sometimes say that I felt like a human trash collector on some days when you looked at the rap sheets and the violence that they committed against innocent people for no reason whatsoever. But I said, let me ask you a stupid question. If I gave you a choice of spending life in jail or take a beating that put you in the hospital for a couple of days, what would you rather have happen to you? Any rational person would say, beat the shit out of me, okay? Right?
Man.
So the best thing you can do in law enforcement is to play by the numbers, play by the rules, do nothing inappropriate, but make sure you make an airtight case where that dirtbag does not have an opportunity to wriggle off the hook. And I have sent many people home to stand trial for murder and drugs and rape and kidnapping, and it was joyful. I'd go out and celebrate after that arrest. And that's the way you conduct business. And 99% of the people I worked with operated exactly the way I'm describing it. You play by the rules. You do it by the numbers. You don't have to worry about being in any kind of a problem. And the best part of it is if you do a really good job, you do nothing that can get this guy to wriggle off the hook and claim he wasn't treated fairly. Right? But understand, when you make an arrest, when someone resists arrest, it becomes a whole different ballgame. If that guy or that gal can overpower you and they can get control of your firearm, you can die. Other people can die. This is now a fight for your survival. People don't realize it, but think about what I'm telling you. You're now in a fight for your survival. I had a situation. I was waiting at a red light right after a major snowstorm in New York. This was around 1993, if I remember correctly. New York was shut down for about 3 or 4 days, which is very unusual, because if there's any city in this country that can deal with a blizzard, it's New York City. We have an army of plows and salting trucks. You name it, we've got the equipment. They even have a machine that uses a jet engine to melt the ice and the snow. We are ready for you name it, throw it at us, we'll do. I don't think any other city could have done what we did after 9/11. New York is a very unique city. If I sound as though I'm proud to be a New Yorker, I am. I truly am. I mean, we were all proud of our hometown, and I'm a Brooklyn boy. I even went to Brooklyn College. You don't get to be more Brooklyn than that. So we've got what it takes, I believe. But on this particular storm, we were overwhelmed, and I'm waiting behind a van that was in front of me. And in New York, there used to be an outfit, I'm not sure if they still exist, called Golden Touch. And they would have big vans and they would have buses that would shuttle people from the hotels to the airports or to the train station, Golden Touch. It was like a limo service, but on large scale. And their vehicles were always immaculately polished. It was a real class situation. So I'm behind one of these Golden Touch vans. A limousine comes out from a side street, and snow is blocking half of the road at this point. And he slams into the side of the Golden Touch van. Now, I'm sitting in a Ford Bronco, big vehicle. It's a government car, no markings on it, but it had lights, sirens, two-way radios. It had all, you know, it's all tricked out with everything. But to look at it from the outside, it just looked like a Ford Bronco, an SUV, right? And the driver of this limo jumps out of the car and starts screaming at the driver of the van. The driver of the van is kind of pudgy. He's balding. He's a couple of years younger than I am. I was almost 50, I guess, at this point, or whatever. But this driver, again, or maybe I was 48. I'm trying to remember what my age was. But you get the idea. And this guy's maybe 40-ish, and he's pudgy. And the limo driver is in his late 20s, and he almost looked like that Israeli that I arrested. Obviously, this guy was having a case of roid rage, 25-inch neck, big muscles. He's standing there in his suit, not even a winter coat, screaming at the driver of the van he just hit. And I'm thinking, this guy's crazy. And the next thing I know, the limo driver punches the van driver in the face and almost knocks him down. And at that point, I blip the siren. I jump out of my truck. The driver that just got hit in the face, turns out, believe it or not, is a New York City detective. That van was borrowed by the NYPD. This guy was a detective with Internal Affairs. They were using it for surveillance. This is a true story. Now picture the scene. And I'm kind of stunned because this guy gets a shot to the face by you know, Attila the Hun, and he looks at the guy and he goes, "You're under arrest." They go, "What?" And he pulls out his badge. He said, "New York City Police, I'm a detective." Now, at this point, the guy threatens him and me. And he jumps back in the van. He had one of his buddies, and they started to take off. And I never pulled a gun on them. I pulled the badge. We cornered him. I followed him, and we cornered him up against the snow bank. And I blocked him in with my SUV, and the detective got on the two-way radio. And in New York, I mean, we have tens of thousands of cops, 36, 37,000 police officers. It's not a police department. It's like a small army. And within 3 or 4 minutes, we had like 24 cops on that corner. So once they were in position, I backed up my truck. They pulled this guy out of the car, and they arrested him. So I accompany them down to the police precinct, and the captain interviews me, and he said, "You're a federal agent." I said, "Yes, I am." He said, "Now, thank you for helping our detective out. At what point did you pull your firearm?" I said, "I never pulled my firearm." He said, "Why not?" I said, "Well, at the moment that I got out of my vehicle, he wasn't continuing the attack. He had punched this guy, but his hands were at his side. He was threatening to kill him. He was threatening to kill me. But my concern was that if our badges didn't slow him down, my gun was likely to get the guy crazed. The guy is twice my size and half my age, and what I envisioned was being in a life-or-death struggle for control of my gun. This was the rush hour. People are all over the place. I'm carrying a .40 caliber semi-automatic a Beretta, and my concern was that with rounds being cranked off, someone's going to get killed. So I never pulled my gun because at that moment I made the quick decision that it would not have been appropriate to use deadly force because there was no life that was being threatened. And if he escalated, then certainly I could always go for the gun. But pulling the gun, I was afraid, would escalate the situation, not calm it down. And the captain was kind of amazed. He said, "Wow, that's really clear thinking." He said, "Do you mind if I make sure you really have your firearm with you?" So I handed my gun to him. I said, "You're welcome to examine it, Captain." He said, "You know, the reasoning you did was perfect." He said, "You should be teaching the deadly force curriculum at the academy." He said, "Do you know many times we have situations where a cop pulls the gun and what happens is exactly what you were concerned about? Now you're in a life and death battle for control of the firearm." Now, I'm telling you the story because every time you're out there interacting with a violent thug, the potential is always there that that thug can gain control of your weapon and kill you, your partner, or other innocent people that are walking by. So when someone resists arrest, this quickly escalates into a battle for that's really life and death. People don't realize it. Unless you've been in that situation, you have no idea. But this is the problem. So when people resist arrest, bad things are going to happen. It doesn't end well. At the very least, generally, resisting arrest winds up with somebody or somebody's in a hospital emergency room. I've seen too many cases like that. We had a guy that we arrested in my office, a little scrawny guy from China. The guy was 5'8", and I don't think he weighed 130 pounds. And when we told him, we're going to have to take you into custody, we're in an interview room. He started throwing furniture at us. It was like a knife fight in a phone booth. So there's like eight of us in this room fighting with a guy who's spitting at us, biting, and trying to throw furniture at us. With all that adrenaline flowing, this little 5'8", 130-pound yo-yo put two of my buddies in the emergency room that night. Resisting arrest doesn't end well. And now what are these geniuses doing in places like New York? Decriminalizing resisting arrest as a crime. Stop and think of the enormity. This is simply going to encourage more idiots to resist arrest when they're encountered by the police. It's almost as though these prosecutors are hoping that things will go bad, so someone else will die, so there'll be more justifications for more riots and more crazy crap going on the street. What do you think of that, James?
I can't disagree, and you see it in basically every major Democrat-controlled enclave in the country. It's not just New York. I know you have firsthand knowledge of it there, but you know it's Philadelphia. It's Los Angeles. It's
the Manhattan Detroit. DA. The Manhattan DA, his last name is Bragg, but he's nothing to brag about, let me tell you. Okay. This is insanity. We had a case where a guy that I had a warrant on, a Jamaican drug dealer, again, Jamaican, not Latino, and I had arrested this guy at least three or four times. He did time for reentry, and then we deported him, and he came back, and he was involved ultimately in what we believe was a fatal shooting. But the informant in the case disappeared, and I warned the cops that this guy's going to disappear. Either he's going to run or someone's going to take him out, but the guy disappeared on us. But this individual came back into the country. I had a warrant for him charging him criminally with reentry. By the way, that's another point I want to make. Fox News a couple of weeks ago said that the Biden administration said that they're not going to detain people when they commit misdemeanors. And among the misdemeanors they describe is reentry after deportation. Folks, let me let you in on something. You can check this out. Everything I tell you is verifiable. Title 8, United States Code, Section 1326, is reentry after deportation. It's a felony. It's a two-year crime if you have no criminal history. Now, I worked with Senator Al D'Amato back in the early 80s. He was our senator in New York, senior senator, to change the law so that a criminal alien who is deported and reenters faces a maximum of 20 years in jail. A 20-year jail sentence is not a misdemeanor in anybody's world, except the twisted world of Pelosi, Schumer, and Joe Biden, okay? So we're talking about the crime of reentry. Well, this guy was a criminal. He had been deported. He came back. I had a warrant. We went to a grand jury, swore out a warrant. I'm in the room next to the interview room processing somebody I had just arrested. So they had the fingerprint machine. They had cameras there and so forth. So I'm doing the paperwork, doing the fingerprinting, and I hear screaming coming from the interview room. There were a couple of interview rooms, but in this one interview room. And I knew this guy's voice because I had arrested him like a half dozen times. And I said, oh, my God, I know who that is. And I go in there, and he had lied about his name. He told my partner, my buddy Richie, who's also in the same squad with me, gave him a fake name. And I walked in, and he just looked up at me. He goes, oh, Mr. Cutler, I'm sorry. I said, You're sorry I'm here. I said, I got news for you to be even more sorry. He said, what's that? I said, I have a warrant charging you, not just administratively, because that's what we do with immigration. There's two elements. administratively, we seek to remove or deport somebody, but criminally, it's like any other crime. You're looking at a jail sentence. I said, you're going to be charged with reentry after deportation as a criminal alien. So my buddy Richie turned over the paperwork to me because I had the warrant on him. He finished the paperwork on the guy I had just arrested, and we went down to arraign this guy. And the federal magistrate, Judge Caden, who was really terrific, they always asked the defendant, were you mistreated by the agent? Because they want to get that out in the beginning so that 8 months from now they don't suddenly, quote-unquote, remember they were mistreated. So they always ask at the time of arraignment, were you mistreated? And this Jamaican drug dealer, thug, who was caught with guns almost every time we arrested him. By the way, if the Democrats hate guns so much, why don't you want immigration agents along? There's a gun charge. Under current law, an illegal alien found in possession of ammunition and or a gun, either way, carries 10 years in jail. If you're that eager to get guns off the street, why don't you bring an immigration agent into the case? Because we can charge somebody as an illegal alien with a firearm. They're looking at 10 years in jail. You see? The laws are amazing if only we were allowed to enforce them. So when we brought this guy in for arraignment, the magistrate said, were you mistreated? And he said, yes, the agent kicked me. He said, the agent kicked you? He said, what started that? He says, well, I punched him in the face and I kicked him. Now picture this. We're in arraignment. So the courtroom is packed and the agents from every agency you could imagine are there, Secret Service, FBI, DEA, ATF, IRS, U.S. Customs. It was a separate agency back then. We're all in this big courtroom. And the magistrate looks at this idiot and says, could you please turn around so I could see all of you? So we turn this guy around so the judge can see 360 degrees of this ugly idiot. And the judge looks at him. He said, so let me understand this. That federal agent, meaning my partner, Richie, told you that you were under arrest and you reacted by punching him and kicking him. And this idiot says to the judge, yes, Your Honor, that's what I did. He said, so in the fight, this agent then kicked you. He says, he kicked me in my seat, meaning his groin. He said, but you're the one that started the fight. He said, yes, Your Honor. And I'll never forget the magistrate, which had everybody in the courtroom sort of laughing. He said, for a guy who decided, and if you knew my partner, he was a weightlifter, by the way, really big mistake. He said, you resist arrest, you kick and punch a federal agent, and you're complaining? He said, for somebody who assaulted a federal officer, you look just dandy. And he said, I have a good mind to add additional charges, which will put you in jail for another 5 years of assaulting a federal officer. What do you mean you punched a federal officer? That's called resisting arrest. I mean, picture the insanity of this. So now we're in a situation where in places like New York, because we're so progressive, I would argue regressive. I hate the word progressive. Resisting arrest is okay. If you can duke it out with the cop and get away, all is forgiven? Is that what we really want? No. I think what they're really looking for are more tragedies, more dead bodies.
Well, exactly, because what cop is not going to go home that night? What cop is going to say to himself, no, I am not going to get out here and take a pounding and run the risk of this guy taking my service weapon? No, they're going to shoot. It's going to get to a point in that struggle. Yeah,
that's right. And so now, why is this happening? So why don't we go back in history? Because the left doesn't want to study history, and you either study history or you're going to relive the tragedies of history. The Third Reich consolidated police departments under an individual by the name of Himmler. And why did they do this? Let me pull up this article here. Bear with me one moment.
Go ahead. We're talking with Michael Cutler, friend of the program, friend of mine, federal agent in Immigration Naturalization Service, 30 years experience in a wide variety of areas as they would pertain to immigration, counterintelligence, drug enforcement, organized crime, immigration fraud.
So here we are. Okay, go ahead. Heinrich Himmler ran the SS, and they then consolidated every law enforcement agency under Himmler. He was a rabid anti-Semite. He ran the concentration camps. They had a program on TV that sickened me. They were showing people being killed by the Third Reich, innocent people being pulled out of their houses, gypsies, Jews, people who had physical disabilities, and being shot in the head and buried. And my family was decimated in the Holocaust. I was named after my mother's mother, who couldn't get out of Poland because of those scumbags. She died, along with many members of her family. My first wife, may she rest in peace, died tragically over 30 years ago to cancer. Her mother was in a concentration camp. Her father's brother was killed by these bastards. The atrocities they committed because the Jews were vilified. The problems of the world are the responsibility of the Jews, almost like what we're hearing about whites today by these people here in this country. And so they showed images of people being marched down the street and put over a big pit, and one after another pushed into the pit, shot in the head, pushed into the pit, shot in the head, and so forth. And then the announcer said that Himmler would sometimes attend these mass shootings, and he was very disturbed about what he saw. Not what you think, folks. He said these young men who were killing these people might be traumatized by the experience of shooting women and children in the head, and that's when he came up with the idea of the gas chambers. Stop and let that sink in. Let it sink in. Think about what I just said to you.
He was That's exactly right. The mental health, they were called Einsatzgruppen.
That the shooters were being traumatized. That the shooters were being traumatized.
When they used them in the East as they were moving through Russia, you know, they were called Einsatzgruppen. And he was concerned about their morale and about their mental welfare at the fact that they were doing this. And they did this everywhere. This was not isolated. This was all throughout Poland, Czechoslovakia, throughout Russia.
Yes.
Everywhere they went to make the Lebensraum that they needed, the living space that they needed, they just eliminated these people.
And so what they did was they made sure that all law enforcement answered to Himmler, because up until then, the police might have been sympathetic with the Jews. They knew them. They were in the neighborhood. So they might have said, we're not going to let anybody know that they're living here. Hitler and Himmler said, you know what? We're going to put them under our command, and now they'll do what they're told, or we'll shoot them in the head. So when you hear people saying that we need to nationalize the police, go back to history, folks. Think about what happened during the Holocaust. Think of what happened with Himmler, with the SS, with the death camps. The idea of putting all law enforcement of an entire nation under the rule of an iron-fisted lunatic, would that happen here? Probably not. I pray it won't. But you know what? Hope is not a strategy. So when I look at what's happening, where people are saying, what are you doing? Babies are being shot. Children are being killed. Women are dying. By the way, the New York Times just wrote an article, because we have an epidemic in New York of Chinese people being viciously attacked, mostly by blacks, by the way. We just had a young woman followed home by a lunatic who was just let out of jail after a violent assault, and he stabbed her to death. They found him hiding under her bed in her apartment. And the New York Times writes an article about how Chinese women are now dominating what used to be the white sport of figure skating, and they want to understand how this has been allowed to happen, basically. This is all race-based inciting violence. It really is. You know, the idea of an ideal society is, number one, the most vulnerable get the greatest amount of protection because they can't fend for themselves. Do you see the victims of crimes being protected? No, who's being protected? The criminals. This turns everything that rational people would think is proper on its ear. The criminals need protection, not the victims of the criminals. Stop and think about that. Critical race theory is dangerous. Should we learn about slavery? Absolutely. Should we learn about the Holocaust? Absolutely. Should we learn about the mistakes that we've made as a people? Absolutely. Why? Because you learn from mistakes. My father taught me that there's no mistakes in life, only lessons, if we learn from what goes badly. So should we learn about slavery? Of course we should. But do you hold people today responsible for actions taken by our country hundreds of years ago? That's insane. We don't hold children responsible for the crimes of their parents. If a guy commits murder, you don't go out and put the child of the murderer in jail, do you? But they would under this nonsense of critical race theory. You can never redeem yourself. Instead of conflict resolution, what this is about is conflict encouragement, conflict instigation instead of conflict resolution. So you can never redeem yourself because of white supremacists. Really? Understand what we're dealing with. This is very dangerous. Scapegoating a group of your citizens by another group of your citizens. Again, where did we see that? In the Third Reich. In the Third Reich, you saw scapegoating of an entire population. It was the Jews, it was the gypsies, it was homosexuals, it was people who had disabilities. They were the problem. They believed in eugenics, that they believed in racial purity. By the way, if they only looked at Hitler, he certainly didn't look quote-unquote Aryan, whatever the hell that was, because it's a make-believe idea, blonde hair, blue eyes. And who's talking about all this nonsense? Old white men, right? Think about that. But rational thought doesn't have to coexist with what they're doing. All you have to do is get people fired up enough, and you'd be amazed. Now, the other thing, if you watch these programs about the Third Reich, is how they use the news media and the entertainment industry to further the images and the messages of the Third Reich. The news should be objective. The facts are the facts. Anybody who used to watch Sergeant Friday, right? Just the facts. So you have a situation unfolding with the Durham investigation not being reported on by the mainstream media. Why? This isn't a major story? How is this not a major story?
Well, because it runs counter to their agenda and their narrative. I mean, it is. It's bigger than anything I've ever seen in politics. And again, it goes back, and this is something I've always said, and it's been a pattern. These things happen. An event happens, whatever it may be. In this case, we'll take a look at the Hillary. All right. Everybody suspects. Everybody looks at the situation. The intelligent and the intellectually honest will look at the situation, and they will assess it in disseminating all this information. They come to the inescapable conclusion much earlier than the press or anyone else will of exactly what happened, and their suspicions are confirmed. We all knew this. I mean, we've known this since it happened, basically. But now that the government and Durham and the wheels of justice have slowly ground this thing out, it comes out to be just exactly what we thought it was.
And what's really interesting to me, and if you think about Richard Nixon, and by the way, I met Richard Nixon briefly one day. It's an interesting story. He had his office in the Federal Building where we had our offices, 26 Federal Plaza. And so I was on vacation. I come back from vacation. It's about 5:30 in the morning. I go into my office to get my raid bag. My raid gear has a bulletproof vest, my raid jacket, extra ammunition, walkie-talkies, handcuffs, extra batteries for my radio. So I grab my – we used to call them battle bags. I grab my battle bag. I'm on my way out the door. And as I'm leaving, and this is 5:30 in the morning, there's nobody else in the building. It's closed to the general public at that hour. Who's coming in but Richard Nixon with his security guard? He didn't have Secret Service. He felt it wasn't appropriate because of the way he left office. So he hired his own private security. And I saw him, and what he did with Watergate was terrible. I mean, if it all pans out, again, no one's been convicted yet, but it's going in that direction. So we are innocent until proven guilty. You know, I believe strongly in the system. But if
yes,
it pans out, this would certainly eclipse Watergate, if that's the case. But the point was, he was the president of the United States, and I was raised a certain way. I saw Richard Nixon. He was no more than 10 feet from me. were kind of like passing each other, and I stopped and I said, "Good morning, Mr. President." Richard Nixon stopped, so I stopped. And he looked at me and he said, "How are you doing this morning, son?" I said, "I'm fine." He said, "You must be a federal agent." And he, from what I was told, he loved federal agents. And I didn't realize that he had served admirably in the Second World War in the Pacific, by the way. He was a veteran. And he was very respectful of agents. Whenever he wrote a book, he would autograph the book, but only for agents, nobody else. And so when he saw me and he said, "You must be a federal agent." I said, "I am." He said, "From the looks of things, son, you're going out to make an arrest." I said, "That's the plan." He said, "You know what the most important thing you will do today?" I said, "Get the guy I'm looking for." He said, "No, son. The most important thing you're going to do today is come home in one piece to your family." I'll never forget that. He said, "And I hope you do come home in one piece. Thank you for your service." I said, "Thank you so much for the kind words, Mr. President. They're appreciated." I saluted him. He saluted me. I got in my car, and he went in the elevator and went upstairs. But what he did at Watergate was wrong. The cover-up was wrong. It's always the cover-up that gets you, okay? Now, it was the Republicans who told Nixon he needed to leave office. They looked at the situation. They said, "This is a disaster. You need to go," instead of circling the wagons. By the way, I have to make a comment as I use the expression "circle the wagons," because it brings us back literally full circle to the immigration issue. Common sense says that when you're under attack, what do? You circle the wagons. What does that mean? Allegorically, what it means is you create a secure perimeter. How in the world, in a dangerous era like this, when we're facing the threat of terrorism, when we're facing the threat of a nuclear Iran, and they have sleeper agents operating in the United States, Hezbollah, and I've spoken about it on your program before, and I've written about it according to congressional testimony at open hearings, Hezbollah working with human traffickers to flood America with narcotics and with sleeper agents and criminals and terrorists. How do you not secure your border against the drugs and the criminals and the terrorists at an era such as the one that we're in right now? America is facing multiple threats, and after the Afghanistan debacle, and I've written about this for Front Page Magazine at frontpagemag.com and U.S. Inc., usincorporated.org, usinc.org, this administration released over 5,000 hardened terrorists in Afghanistan. We have an open border. We have terrorists on the move. Our people just took out the leader of ISIS. You don't think they'd want to come to America for reprisals and retribution against us? So think about circling the wagons and then ask yourself, why in the world would a president of the United States of America act in opposition to common sense and historically what you normally do? There's a threat. You batten down the hatches. You circle the wagons, right? Aren't those the expressions that we use? There's a storm coming. Batten down the hatches. Secure your perimeter. We're being left vulnerable by an administration who I believe seeks profit from that open border. It's remarkable. I was with Michael Chertoff many years ago. We both spoke at Chapman Law School. And Michael Chertoff and I and Asa Hutchins wound up spending about 45 minutes in the back of a stretch limo as we went from the Nixon Library, where we had dinner, to our hotel. We were staying in the same hotel. And we got into this whole big discussion, and he said to me, "We can't hire enough agents. Where are you going to get the money?" Because I said, "We only have 6,000 ICE agents, and only 2,000 roughly are dedicated to immigration enforcement. Now look where we are. We have 6,000 ICE agents, and none of them are doing immigration work. They're all doing, you know, kiddie porn, money laundering, intellectual property theft." Just before the Super Bowl, there was a big press release how ICE agents were working closely, shoulder to shoulder with local law enforcement. You think that's good news? No. What were they doing? Making sure that nobody was producing counterfeit jerseys and T-shirts and so forth. Really, that's the priority for Homeland Security, counterfeit T-shirts. Outrageous stuff. So Mike Chertoff said to me, "Well, there's no money to hire more agents." I said they would pay for themselves. Every year, tens of billions of dollars in money earned by aliens who shouldn't be here leave the United States. Think of the impact that has on the economy. It's destroying wages, which destroys the tax base. Instead of being taxpayers, Americans are people that need help from the safety net programs that cost us a fortune. We're stealing the American dream from American children. And he sat there and didn't know what to say. So Asa Hutchins, realizing that he had nowhere to go with this conversation, tried to change the topic. And this was right after that incident where I forget the guy's name, but I came to call him Captain Underpants, tried to blow up an airplane on the way into Detroit International Airport. And he talked about that. I think his name was Omar Talib, if I remember correctly. And he said, didn't Janet Napolitano do a brilliant job? Doing what? And I said to him, I said, oh, wait a minute. I said, Napolitano did a brilliant job. That guy was stopped by people on the airplane. I said, you know, if hope is not a strategy, then dumb luck is not a success. And I thought the two of them were going to try to jump out the window of the limousine. Now, the reason I'm telling you about Chernoff saying that we don't have the money to hire immigration agents, you do realize that today Biden wants to hire, do you know how many Internal Revenue agents?
86,000 or more.
Around there, yes. Now, why? So I want you again to understand what we're looking at. If you hire IRS agents, it's not about revenue, I believe. They could then become the new secret police. And they could use their authority selectively, just as we saw when under Obama, conservative groups couldn't get certification from the IRS. Do you remember that deal?
Oh, so yeah, the Tea Party groups, they were slow.
Go after. That's right. And what winds up happening, and this was something else that Nixon tried to do, which was reprehensible. He had a political enemies list and wanted to use the Internal Revenue Service to go after his political enemies. So now an administration that doesn't care about aliens who lie on applications for immigration benefits like citizenship, which, by the way, is a national security threat according to the 9/11 Commission, right? That's okay. Mayorkas, the guy that runs DHS, I now call the Department of Homeland Surrender, has said that if an alien lies on their application for citizenship, we're not going to do anything to them. We've given them citizenship, and they have every right to feel secure, that the world is just fine, everything is peachy keen, and they can stay here forever. We will not act against them unless they're war criminals. Really. The 9/11 Commission found immigration fraud was a big deal. In fact, when our guys took out bin Laden and they went through his library and seized those documents, I went through a partial list of what was inventoried. There was a copy of the 9/11 Commission report, not a shock, also an application for U.S. citizenship. And if you read through the indictments and the information and press releases about the terrorists that have been arrested in the United States, they were all coached by their overseas handlers telling them, do not act until you get U.S. citizenship and acquire a U.S. passport, because once they have two passports, they switch passports back and forth to cover their tracks as they travel around the world. So it not only endangers us, but it endangers our allies. Well, Mayorkas has now said, and he's running DHS, or should I say ruining DHS, that we will take no action against people who lie on applications for citizenship. But God help you if you fudge on your tax returns by as little as $600, because the IRS is coming for you. And they're going to tell those IRS people, I am sure, that we're hiring you to generate enough money to justify your paycheck, so you better come up with stuff if you want to keep your job. So what Biden wants to do, again, is crack down on American citizens. The Americans are the problem. As we were approaching the anniversary of 9/11, DHS put out a whole big article, a bulletin about national security concerns. And what were the concerns? About radicalized Americans who would attack America. Not about aliens coming here on visas or fake documents or running our borders, but on Americans who might be radicalized by material on the internet to launch attacks inside the United States. This administration is focusing on American citizens, not one bit on foreign nationals who come here who may be involved in criminal activities. And where are the Republicans? Why didn't the Republicans want a border wall? They wouldn't give Trump the money for the border wall when they controlled both houses, would they? By the way, the border wall was never designed to keep people out of the United States. Now, this may shock you. So I'm going to repeat it again, and I'm going to explain this to you very nice and easily. The border wall was never, ever intended to stop the entry of a single person into the United States of America. And if you think I'm crazy, that might be a separate argument. My wife might have an opinion on that. But, well, I'm a realist. But here's the deal. The border wall does not block ports of entry. So what's the purpose for the border wall? To funnel all people and all commerce through ports of entry so they can be vetted and we can create a record of entry, which is what the 9/11 Commission recommended. Chuck Schumer was so concerned about trespassing that he wanted a federal law, this was about 8 years ago, that would make trespass on critical infrastructure or national landmarks a federal crime with a 5-year jail sentence. He said, on the local level, it's a misdemeanor with no more than 1 year in jail. These people are being put in jail for a couple of months. It doesn't discourage them. Anybody who trespasses, even if you're a young kid and an adrenaline junkie, trespass is dangerous, and you need to go to jail. That's how we're going to stop trespassing. I would argue that people that evade the inspections process are trespassing. So the same Schumer who wants to put kids that, like this kid, and it was actually on his official Senate website, there was a 16-year-old who climbed the World Trade Center under construction, the new Freedom Tower, so he could take a selfie. And Schumer said that that kid needed to go to jail for 5 years because what he did was dangerous and irresponsible, and he needs a lesson. But the same Schumer said that when people run the border, that's okay. We should give them citizenship. And why are the Republicans not arguing against it? Why do you have Republicans who want to give lawful status to millions of people, so many people that there could be no interviews and no field investigations? So I come back to my initial question. How is this in the best interest of the average American? Americans no longer believe that the system is working for them. And that's a brilliant observation because it's not. The system is working for the super powerful and the super wealthy, period. And we're seeing this around the world. It's a move towards universal tyranny, not universal freedom. I recently wrote an article about how President Kennedy, 60 years ago, warned about the adversaries of freedom, how around the world in the Southern Hemisphere, people were being attacked when they tried to create free governments and imbue their people with a level of democracy. And he said, I don't care what your road to freedom is, whatever it is, we should stand behind you. And he talked about how they would launch assassinations and use local talent to kill people to instill a fear so that they could snuff out the flames of freedom that were growing in many countries around the world. He talked about how 4,000 civil servants, officials were killed in Vietnam, for example, by insurgents. How many people have been killed in America since we've had this defund the police movement? And Pelosi says, oh, that's not what we're about. Really? Of course that's what they're about. How many children have been killed? In New York, a couple of days ago, within a 24-hour period, we had 11 shootings. 3 or 4 of them were fatal. Children being shot to death in their own beds here in New York City. It's like the Wild West. A woman puts her baby in the back of her car, gets into the driver's seat, hears a loud bang, turns around, and her little 6 or 8 month old baby is dead. The bullet penetrated the baby's skull out of nowhere. This is a reign of terror. I don't know any other way of describing it. And if you look at what Kennedy warned about, how the tyrants around the world, that he specifically talked about China and Russia and Cuba, were acting violently to snuff out the flames of freedom that were growing in the Southern Hemisphere. Aren't we seeing that here within our own cities? And now you've got AOC running around saying, well, if democracy survives. No, they don't want democracy to survive. And one of the tricks that I've been seeing from the Democrats is they accuse their opponents of what they themselves are doing. It's projected reality. It's projected reality. And all the Republicans can think about is winning office and making more money, not about whether they're living up to their obligation of looking out for the average American. This elitist mindset is beyond belief. It is off the charts. It's off the charts. and you have people who've never studied communism. When I went to school, we studied communism. And we learned about something known as the collective farms in Russia, something that they call the kolkhozes. And it's funny that all these years later, something that I learned in junior high and then high school again has stayed with me for a lifetime. The idea of communism on paper is brilliant. One of the big problems with academia, two of the most dangerous words in the world are in theory. In theory. In theory, if I jump out the window, I should be able to flap my arms and fly like a bird, right? In theory. In theory, communism is brilliant. To each according to his needs, from each according to his ability. There's a little problem with that, though. My dog is a capitalist, okay? People are capitalists at heart. What does that mean? You want to be rewarded for what you do. If you learn anything about training a dog or training a horse or training other beasts of burden, there's always got to be a reward for what the animal does. The dog, you say, give me your paw. The dog gives you his or her paw, and you give them a little treat. You tell them, come, and you give them a little treat. That's a reward. That's how capitalism is supposed to work. You work harder, you get more treats. You work harder, you have a nicer house. You work harder, you get that sports car you've been lusting after. You work a little harder, and you go on that vacation, or you go to that more expensive restaurant, or you fill your freezer with ice cream like Nancy Pelosi, right? That's the theory. But what are we now doing? Importing an army of foreign workers to displace American workers. So the Americans are chasing after a dream that doesn't even exist anymore. If you know anything about the dog races in Florida, and I've been there, the dogs, the greyhounds, chase a mechanical rabbit. Of course, they never get to the rabbit. They just keep chasing it. They run themselves ragged chasing a rabbit. They never get a catch. That's the average American today chasing an American dream that's nothing more than a dream. Why? Well, if you look at the purchasing power of the average American, it keeps on declining every year. Forget inflation. Now we're really seeing this on steroids. But the more foreign workers you bring into America, the less value labor has. Labor is a commodity. The De Beers Company in Belgium controls the number of gem-quality diamonds that are released onto the market every year. They do that to control the price. If they flooded the diamond market with as many gemstone quality diamonds as they could possibly produce, diamonds would be worth little more than cut glass. By controlling the quantity, it makes it rare. The rarer that diamonds are, the more valuable they become. In fact, in economics, if you flood a commodity onto the market to drive down wages, you're committing a felony, and it's appropriately called dumping. What we're seeing in America, and we've been seeing this now for decades, is the dumping of labor into the labor pool in America to drive down the worth of labor. Who benefits? The super wealthy. Who doesn't benefit? The working stiffs who are trying to feed themselves and their families. And it's not just the illegal aliens. Go back to Alan Greenspan. This includes the high-tech workers, the H-1Bs, and the people getting green cards because they're highly skilled. This is anti-American. It's against the middle class. It's against the free market. They'll tell you it's free market. Well, it is and it isn't. Free market works if you keep it within the American system. You don't pay enough money, people won't take the job, so you offer more money, and eventually someone will say, that's a really crappy job, but for that kind of money, I'll do it. But what you're seeing from the super conservatives, $15 an hour, that's outrageous. Well, let me tell you, $15 an hour is $30,000 a year. You can't support a dog in New York City on $30,000 a year, folks. The cheapest apartment in New York City will probably run you close to $2,000 a month. That's $24,000 a year of your net money. That doesn't include electricity or food or clothing or transportation to your job if you have a job. So how in the world do you support yourself on $30,000 a year? You can't. And that's just getting by as a bare minimum subsistence. Is that the American dream? That if you're lucky, you can put the lights on when you come home at night, at least one light bulb can be on in your apartment? Is that the American dream? When I was a kid, most of my friends' parents had two cars in their driveway, and they bought the cars for cash. Today, people lease cars because they can't afford one car. And it keeps getting worse. And part of what contributes to this insanity is the massive influx of foreign workers. We're bringing in more workers every year than the number of new jobs we're creating. And that's before this human tsunami that was encouraged by Joe Biden. And now we're flooding America with narcotics. Over 100,000 people died of opiate overdoses last year. That doesn't include people who were killed by criminals engaged in the drug trade. They're super violent. I know I spent half my career doing narcotics investigations. These people are crazy. I've taken submachine guns out of apartments and out of the backseat of a car we were following. All right? That's a level of violence you can't begin to imagine. It doesn't include people who are addicted to drugs, who carry out violent street crime so that they can get the money to get their fix. And now we're told about social justice. So let me ask you another question. Is it really social justice that we release criminals? They're 19, 20, 22 years old. They've committed a violent crime. You release them. They go back on the street. They injure more people. Generally, it's people of color, by the way. It's happening in their own neighborhoods. Although now all of New York is a free fire zone. We have a ring system in my house. And every time there's an armed robbery or a shooting or a stabbing, and it's everywhere. I mean, there's no such thing as a good neighborhood in New York City. The city's going to go the way of the dinosaur at the rate we're going, which really upsets me tremendously. But let's switch things. And I'm working on an article that we don't need critical race theory, but critical empathy theory. So let's put ourselves in the case of that 19-year-old kid who is functionally illiterate because he or she never really bothered with school. They came from a broken home. There was no encouragement to work or go to school or do anything. They joined a gang, and they're living day to day. They wake up in the morning. If they're not hooked on drugs, then the first thought is, how do I get food? If they're hooked on drugs, the first thought is, how do I get drugs? And then how do I get food? They don't have bank accounts. They don't have a steady job, certainly. So more than likely, they go out there in the morning and they say to themselves, well, who am I going to rob today? These aren't people that are ever going to live a decent life or a long life or a productive life. They're not looking to the future. When I was growing up, my friends and I would think, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? My friend's parents always asked me that question. I thought I was going to be an aerospace engineer. Two of my kids now are engineers. Things don't always work the way we plan. But you think about the future. One of my friends, and he actually did it, said, I'm going to be a surgeon. Another one said, I'm going to be a lawyer. And he did. We have dreams of the future. Do you think kids that wind up in gangs and committing crime think about the future? Their future to them is sunrise tomorrow morning. That's the distant future for them is sunset tomorrow night. They're not thinking, where am I going to be 10 years from now? Where am I going to be 15 years? What kind of a house should I buy? Where do I want to move? No. They're thinking survival on a day-to-day level. And every time they commit a robbery, they run a very real risk that the guy behind the counter will take out a gun or a baseball bat and get them before they get the guy they're trying to rob. It happens all the time. This isn't a good career choice, okay? It's not a good lifestyle. But we keep hearing about social justice means releasing criminals. Folks, if you really want to talk about social justice, let's have that conversation. But it starts when a child is born, a child that grows up in a loving, secure family with secure food, clean, wholesome environment. That creates greater opportunities that that child will live a wonderful, successful, fulfilling life. Children who grow up in chaos are far less likely to be successful. So if you really want social justice, why is nobody talking about the environments in which these children are living and growing up? Why aren't we, and you and I had this discussion, James, last week, why aren't we teaching children in junior high and high school, where many kids are now having kids, which is another prescription for disaster, why aren't we teaching children instead of the various kinds of sexual orientations that might exist in someone's fantasy-twisted brain about the responsibilities that go with parenting? I can't tell you how proud I am to be the father of four wonderful children, and they in turn have thus far given me four incredible grandchildren. To me, being a parent is the most important job I will ever have. I'm proud to have been a federal agent for 30 years. But when people say to me, I was on a radio show not long ago, the guy said, well, what are you proudest of? I guess he was hoping I would talk about one of my investigations. And I said, what am I proudest of? My four kids. Why aren't we teaching children in school that having a child carries with it lifelong responsibilities so that they take that whole business of becoming a parent far more seriously and so that they're far less cavalier about some guy being able to brag that he's had five kids with four different women? That doesn't generally end well for the children. This is a societal problem that we should be addressing with our own children in America and encouraging them to seek greatness. It used to be that corporations looked at children in school and saw in those kids their future employees. So outfits like the GE College Bowl came to be because General Electric looked at those college kids and said, among these kids are our future engineers and scientists and technicians. We better give them encouragement to do well in school. These companies don't look to American colleges for their future workers unless the students that they're looking at came here from the third world, so they'll accept third world wages. All that these companies want is for the American citizens to buy the garbage that they're peddling, not to help design or build it, because they've got people like Alan Greenspan hawking for them this notion of driving down wages by making American workers compete with foreign workers, which under current law is illegal, and that's why they want to redo the immigration laws to remove that troublesome paragraph that addresses this notion of protecting American workers from foreign competition. What do you think of that, James?
I think it's a tragedy what's happening to this country. But, well, you know, they're squeezing out the middle class. They want to eliminate it. And they're well on their way to doing it.
Am I getting anything wrong in what I'm saying to you?
No, absolutely.
By the way, do you think I'm getting anything wrong here, James?
Absolutely not. And to touch back on, you know, what you were talking about, which was fundamentally, you know, far too many people in this country living paycheck to paycheck and yep. not making it. It's soul crushing. It grinds
and
people.
And they don't understand what communism is. You see, I started talking about the Kolchoz. Now, what was remarkable was that in Russia, they would give a farmer 10 acres of land for the state and 1 acre of land for himself. You know that 1 acre always outproduced the 10 acres? Now, to show you how stupid Russia was, they should have just given these people 11 acres and said, we're going to keep 90% of what you grow. You know?
Right.
That would have been a better model. But they said, no, that's your acre, and these are our 10 acres. So where do you think they focused their work? On that 1 acre that was going to feed them and their families. That's why communism doesn't work. So we come back to one other principle. There's only two ways to motivate beasts of burden and human beings. It's the carrot or the stick. In true capitalism, and we don't have true capital, this is corporate welfare. And by the way, this virus killed off how many small businesses and made the big box stores that much wealthier and more powerful, right? That was a byproduct, and I'm not so sure it was unintentional. You could go to Target, you could go to Costco, you could go to Walmart, but you can't go to Joe's TV store down the block. Remember that whole business?
Absolutely.
So they got rid of the competition of the small businessman. But at least in theory, in capitalism, if you work hard, you get rewarded. So that's the carrot. Under communism, that doesn't exist. Well, what's the alternative to the carrot? The stick. And increasingly, and if you look at what just happened in Canada overnight, and you listen to this rhetoric about white radicals, white supremacists, what are our so-called democracies turning to? The stick. You'll do it our way or else. What do you think of that assessment?
I think that it is ultimately, and you're right, you're dead on it. Ultimately, though, it is destined, I feel, to failure. I really do.
I think the American people are going to at some point wake up, and they're going to say, we've had enough of your crap. There's 535 people in the House and Senate, and there's 330 million of us. And in fact, some trucker said something very similar yesterday. They were interviewing on Fox News up in Canada. He said 40 or 400 people, whatever the number is, going to tell me how to live my life and whether or not I'm supposed to get a vaccine and my children are supposed to get vaccinated. Who are these people that they think they can run my life for me? And I think that they're going to find themselves overextending, which brings me to a piece of optimism. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who I thought was a brilliant woman, doesn't mean I always agreed with her. And by the way, folks, we need to learn how to disagree with one another in a civil way and in an intellectual way, because we're always going to disagree. That's the beauty of the First Amendment. We've forgotten what this is about. We've become armed camps. You're my way or the highway. No, no, no. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg, from my neighborhood, in fact, my kids went to the same high school that she went to, and they dedicated a moot court to her. I've been in that moot courtroom. After 9/11, in fact, they had me address the student body at that high school, James Madison High School. I was very honored. And I think two of my kids were mortified because they were in the audience at the time. This was just a couple of months after 9/11, after I'd been before Congress. But Ruth Bader Ginsburg brilliantly observed that the mascot of the United States should not be the bald eagle, but the pendulum. And she said, any time one side or the other pulls America too far to the radical left or the radical right, extremist right, we as a country have always had the good sense to pull back towards the center. I think it's coming. But I think the American people need to stop thinking about voting for candidates based on that little R or that little D, because it means bupkis. We need to support candidates that truly look out for the average American. And I don't care if they're with the Hopping Kangaroo Party. What do you think of that?
I have said this for many, many years now. You want to change Washington, and we all do, because it's rotten to the core. It's corrupt. It's horrible, and it's both sides. I'm not even going to say those damn Democrats or whatever. It's everybody. And if you want to do this, I have thought that it has to be, and the only way it can be done, the only way that it can be done and be successful is through an informed and disseminating electorate.
Yep. I couldn't
agree
more. They
talk about
term
limits.
That's why the news media is so important.
Oh, yeah, you know, and they talk about term limits, and I say to myself, okay, that's great, yeah. I understand that. And it was, I do this every time. Orrin Hatch. It was Orrin Hatch that said it was impossible to go to Washington and return an honest man. Okay, I understand term limits. But my point also is you voted them in, you can vote them the hell out. And that's where the informed and disseminating
electorate comes. I used to agree with that. But let me tell you why I disagree. Now, I do believe in term limits now for another reason. I've had candidates approach me about helping them run for office. Okay, and I'm very honored. I was approached about running, and I entertained the idea for about a week, and then I aggravated myself thinking, why did it take me a whole week to figure out that I don't want to play around in that cesspool? What was I thinking? You know, my wife was willing to go any which way that I wanted to, because she's been supportive of what I've been doing. Ever since the day that Jeff Sessions quoted me from the floor of the Senate when I wrote an op-ed for the Washington Times around 2006 about comprehensive immigration reform, and I gave it a new name. I called it the Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act. And then he sent me a wonderful certificate. I'm looking at it right now. It hangs on the wall of my office. By the way, my office used to be my bedroom when I was a kid. I'm living in the same house that my parents bought when I was 11 years old. And some of my kids have used this bedroom also. So I couldn't feel more at home than I do at this very moment. But he said that it was his belief that his ability to use my words during the contentious floor debate on three separate days gave enough of his colleagues a perspective that they needed so that they voted down very dangerous legislation. So my wife has been very supportive of me about whatever it is that I want to do at this point. But I came to realize something, because as I've been helping people that are running for office, what you find is that when people run against a congressman or a senator in a safe seat, the parties will not fund them, and they don't take that race seriously. So if you're running against Chuck Schumer, if you're running against Nadler, the candidates that are being put up by the Republicans don't get funding at all, because the party looks and they say, oh, There's no way Nadler's going to be defeated. So because he has the, quote, safe seat, Republicans won't give that candidate funding to even put up one television commercial. Think about that. So, again, it comes back to the funding of campaigns. There should be no money in politics. As far as I'm concerned, every news organization should have to give up X amount of minutes of airtime to candidates who have X number of votes on petitions so that they're, you know, serious, viable candidates. Not serious and viable because they have a war chest of $5 million. That seems to be the standard today. No, serious candidates should be given airtime, and between airtime and the ability to use the internet, there should be no campaign funding the way we have it today. And then you hear this garbage, right? Oh, I only take the money, $10 and $20 contributions. And then they have people working for the parties called bundlers, right? They bundle up these $20 contributions. Yeah, sure thing. That's called money laundering and structuring, okay? And then you have these candidates saying, well, I don't take PAC money. Yes, they do. Every candidate that you ever heard of takes PAC money, you know, political action committee money. And here's how it works. The PAC gives the money to the two parties, and the two parties distribute that money to the candidates
right.
who do what they're told.
Absolutely.
So when you hear these lies and this BS, oh, I don't take PAC money. I take it a vow. I'm not saying you had a congressman in Florida do that. A Democrat and a Republican shook hands and they did this little program together. It was like a high school skit. We've taken the vow. No PAC money. Yeah, okay, right. I was born on a Wednesday, not last Wednesday. So they don't take PAC. The parties take the PAC money. And then the party calls Charlie in. They say, hey, Charlie, how would you like $3 million? Oh, great. Well, you see this, you see this, and you see that. Those are our three priorities. When those bills come up, are you on board with us? Yes, sir. Here's your money.
Absolutely,
Charlie.
I am. Yeah.
So when you hear this crap, they get 18 Pinocchios just for breathing at that point. All right? So understand what's happened. All that money has made the whole system polluted. And what Donald Trump did, and they didn't always agree with Donald Trump. There were times, you know, his worst enemy was his own mouth and his own Twitter account. But he wasn't taking their money. And he used the one word that scared them more than any word, the S word, sovereignty. When he said sovereignty, you could hear bathrooms flushing all over the United States. I was told by people affiliated with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, I call them the Chamber of Horrors, that I was the one who thought our borders were our first line of defense, first and last line of defense. For them, the borders of the United States were an impediment to their wealth. And if they could move people and money and products around the world freely, they could make even more money. Now, this is remarkable because the people we're talking about aren't worried if they're going to be able to buy a hamburger tomorrow morning. They're people who have their own airliners and mansions scattered around the world, but they need more money. These super wealthy, super powerful people are a malignancy. Cancer has an insatiable appetite for nutrients to the point where the tumor secretes hormones so that the body envelops the tumor with a network of blood vessels so that that cancerous tumor can bathe in nutrients and grow and flourish, starving off the healthy tissue. But of course, cancer doesn't have a brain, neither do our politicians for the most part. So the cancer doesn't know that it's sealing its own fate because when that tumor kills the tumor gets buried in the same coffin. The super wealthy that are destroying America and the American dream are sealing the fate of our country. They're sealing the fate of their children and their grandchildren. I mean, how much ice cream can Nancy Pelosi squirrel away for her grandchildren? You have to wonder what kind of evil lurks behind those eyes of hers. A woman who could care less about the plight of the people that sent her to Congress. And, you know, it tells you who she is. I once wrote an article, I'm thinking about resurrecting the title, Governing Under the Influence. To these people, power is intoxicating. They're getting higher and higher and higher in power and in the emotions and the endorphins that it releases in the minds of these sick bastards. So they are on a quest for unlimited power. But if she ever looked in the mirror, Nancy Pelosi's face, you know, if she ever sneezed, it might shatter. You know, you'd have to wear a bulletproof vest if you're standing within a 20-foot radius of her. We're getting old. No one lives forever. Instead of looking back and saying, what's my legacy? How will history remember me? Did I really help to make this world better by being here? She doesn't care. All that she cares about is how much power she has and how much she can lord over other people who aren't her. Schumer is no better. Hillary Clinton is no better. This blind drive for power, it's pathological. It's destroying America. It's destroying our country. It's destroying the future of our children. And we need to stand up. And we need to, first of all, when you meet members of Congress, please don't call them congressman or senator. I call them by their first name. We need to establish the employer-employee relationship from the get-go. Okay? They are not better than us. They aren't the, you know, the muckety-mucks they think they are. Their job description is represent the citizens in your district, represent the citizens who live in your state. That's their job. They represent us, just like when you hire a lawyer, just like when you hire an accountant. They're supposed to be doing your work. They euphemistically call the House of Representatives the people's house. We've allowed them to do this to us because, as my father said to me, I would teach people how they should treat me by demonstrating what I'm willing to accept. For far too long, we've been willing to accept the crap that they've been peddling, and that needs to stop. We need to have conversations with our neighbors. Let's leave the personalities out of it. Let's stop talking about political parties. Let's start talking about real-world impact that everything that's happening is having on us. And by the way, your neighbors who are considerate and compassionate, I've seen too many conservatives refer to them as bleeding heart liberals. That term enrages me on a level you can't begin to imagine. Just like when George W. Bush said, I'm a conservative, I'm a compassionate conservative. Why did he think he needed to add the word compassionate? Because he really knew that there was nothing compassionate about the garbage that he was peddling. So we got to falsely identify as being compassionate. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. We all want to help people that are starving, but we don't invite people into our homes if they're homeless. Although in California, they're now recommending people do that. I'd like to find out how many people Nancy Pelosi and Dianne Feinstein are going to invite to live in their living rooms, okay? But the point of the matter is America, as we're finding out in increasing numbers, is a country of finite resources. First obligation should always be that a country takes care of its own citizens the way that a family makes its first obligation the care and well-being of their own children. It's wonderful to give money to charity, but not when your own children are going to bed hungry at night. For all the talk about how the immigrants want this and the immigrants want that, why aren't we taking care of American kids? Why aren't we providing free college for American children? And I know that news and those folks have a cow anytime that comes up. But American kids should have the opportunity of a good education. Children living in poverty can't do that. And student loans today create such a burden that even kids that graduate with that degree and wind up working in a technical field will never pay off their student loan. It's a lead life preserver that we saddle them with. Why shouldn't we provide an education to American children in the professions where we need the workers, engineers, doctors, technicians, chemists, biologists, instead of worrying about how we're going to bring people in from other countries to benefit from the American educational system? That educational system, first and foremost, should be helping to build up the ability of American children to live successful lives, be better members of our society. They'll be able to pay taxes. They'll be able to spend money. If you want to talk about an economic stimulus program, help American kids truly become part of a vibrant middle class that we used to have. That was what made America the envy of the world. If you destroy the middle class, folks, you're destroying the heart and soul of America. American kids have to go to high school. Why? because 100 years ago, a high school diploma was the equivalent of a bachelor's degree today. Times have changed. Technology has changed. It's time for the system to keep pace with the progress. American children who want to study for the technical fields should be able to get a solid education for free, provided they work within those industries. It would help America, it would help them, and it would secure the future of our nation. You're an educator, James. What do you think of my proposal?
I think you're absolutely right. The investment in this nation's children should be no expense spared. There's no excuse for every kid in this country to not get the commensurate level of education that they desire to have. None.
Well, by the way, we got to be clear. We're not talking about lawful immigrants. We're not talking about dreamers.
No.
Folks, we are talking about American citizen children.
Absolutely.
How's yes. that?
Absolutely. And it doesn't have to be college. If he wants to learn how to be a diesel mechanic, wants to learn to work on whatever it is, yeah.
My dad was a tradesman, and I have to tell you, tradesmen rock. And you know what engineers are when you come down to it? They're professional tradesmen, aren't they?
Right. Yeah.
Right? And when someone says, I'm getting a degree in women's studies, let me tell you a secret. I majored in women's studies, but only on weekends when I was in college. Any yeah. course of study that has the word studies after it is a make-believe curriculum. We need American kids to go to school so that they're equipped to be successful and productive adults. School should be thought of as boot camp for the rest of the lives of American kids. How's that for an analogy?
I agree. It should whatever form that education comes in, whether it's vocational, technical, whether it's mechanical, whether it's through the university system, doesn't matter.
No, and there's nothing wrong with an apprenticeship in the trades. My dad was a plumber. Many of his friends were electricians and so forth. That work is vital for America. It's rewarding work. It's essential work, and without them, you don't have a country. Without construction workers, we'd all be living under a tree somewhere or in a cave. We've got to go back to honoring people that actually do real work and produce something that you can hold in your hand at the end of the day.
Absolutely. It's that particular thread in the tapestry of our country, in our culture, that has held this country together.
It's amazing, isn't it, how we've so devalued? Well, they have that wonderful job about the dirtiest jobs. Listen, it's about doing work that's essential for society. We all have an instrument to play in this incredible orchestra that we call the United States of America. What we should be doing is encouraging American kids to find whatever it is they find joy in doing, because what you enjoy doing, you'll probably do better than anything else and be satisfied at the end of the day when you go home at night, don't you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mike, we've got about 3 minutes left. Why don't you tell us a little bit about where people – yeah, it does. It blisters by. What you've got going on, where you're going to be, who you're going to be speaking with, and maybe a little bit about your radio show and who you're writing for these days.
Well, I'm writing for two websites. I'm writing for Front Page Magazine, frontpagemag.com, and that's sponsored by the David Horowitz Freedom Center. I'm very proud to have been affiliated with them going back to around 2014. I also write for U.S. Inc., U.S. Incorporated. It's usinc.org. I write a twice-a-month blog for them. And I do the Michael Cutler Hour on Blog Talk Radio, Friday night, 7 o'clock East Coast time. And if you go to the Michael Cutler Hour, you can click on the links. And what I do, I used to do interviews, and people said, you know, Mike, there's so much going on every week. Why don't you just come on and do an analysis of all the crazies that have been happening in the past 7 days?
Yep.
And there's never a shortage of topics, I have to tell you.
Oh, believe me, there's plenty to talk about. Right.
Oh, my gosh. And you'd be amazed at how much immigration is a major element. But we look at other factors, too. But mostly with my background, I like to focus on immigration because I always like to make the point that immigration isn't a single issue, but it's a singular issue that impacts everything from national security and public safety to public health, the economy, the environment, education, you name it. It really hammers everything. It's back in the news as the number one issue, but it even impacts inflation. It impacts the environment. And that's why I wrote a piece not long ago where I said that anytime they want to have a discussion about opening up the numbers of immigrants we allow into the country, don't you think they should do an environmental impact study before they even talk about bringing more people in? Because every person who's here has an environmental footprint. Everyone needs more than a pillow to sleep on. Do you know the average person needs 85 gallons of water per day just for sanitary purposes and cooking? And then you need more water to irrigate the farms, to grow the food that every person needs. And we have a drought shortage, a drought right now, water shortage that's historic on the West. So before we start opening up the floodgates to humanity, we better make sure we have water to take care of them and electricity and food and housing. No one talks about the impact because the super wealthy believe that they're insulated and isolated. But at the end of the day, we all share the same planet, and you would think that our political so-called leaders would be good stewards of this country and America's resources, and that starts with the way we deal with immigration at our borders. So I try to provide that perspective, and I hope that that information is useful when you sit down with your neighbors to have those conversations. Your neighbor who disagrees with you only disagrees because they don't understand the issue. Provide them with the facts. Provide them with morality, the law, common sense. Let me tell you, this is an easy argument to win, an easy conversation to have, but it has to be based on facts, and it has to be crystal clear. So my recommendation, forward my articles to your friends and neighbors. Forward the link
Absolutely.
To my podcasts to your friends and neighbors, and let's have those conversations, and let's celebrate that First Amendment. What do you think of that, James?
I think you're spot on, and as usual, you have brought us down to the last 30 seconds of the program. So once again, Michael, I want to thank you for being here. And again, and while I'll just say this, the way you put it, it kind of transcends a singular issue into a seminal, almost an existential issue for the country in terms of its security. That's all
absolutely.
The time we've
Remember,
got, my friend.
Democracy is not a spectator sport.
Absolutely, it is. God bless you, Mike. Thank you so much for being with us, and we look forward to having you back real soon. As always, I appreciate your generosity.
Be well. Stay safe, everybody. Thank you, John.
All right. Bye-bye. Oh, man. That's it.